like a good sort of grouping of this panel, because many of the points which have been raised so far sort of fit very well in the work I'm going to try and present now. I'd also like to mention this is preliminary work, and I would appreciate lots of feedback and any advice along the way, well, afterwards, one-to-one. I'm starting with a quote, and it's actually in the top of my abstract. This quote is from some interviews that I was actually doing about feminist mothering and how feminist mothering of sick boys. And I was talking to somebody, and this person started talking about the period of the counterinsurgency. He said, "It was a terrible time for us. It was very bad for all six. Did you know the Punjab police would strip sick girls naked and parade them through the whole village? They would force all of us to stand outside of our homes and watch. They would not even let you look away. They would force you to look." And as I read this, I'm reminded of the warning note I put on top of my talk, just to warn everybody that I'm going to be talking about gendered sexual violence, which has, lovely has told us, can trigger. And so if anybody feels they need to leave, I completely understand. This middle-aged man was talking about the period of the counterinsurgency, of where in his own village, sick girls were stripped naked and paraded through the village. This is an example of a degradation ceremony, a counterinsurgency tactic periodically employed by the Indian security forces, where the families of suspected insurgents, political activists, or their sympathizers were directly targeted in order to attack and weaken the insurgency. The family members are subjected to intense violence and humiliation in the full view of their fellow villagers, and so to maximize the psychological impact of this crime at an individual and a community level by raping in public. The efficacy of this tactic arises from its function to not merely damage an individual or their family, but the larger community. Gendered sexual violence during conflict has long been recognized as a highly strategic and symbolic act that causes devastating harm to the individual and serves to disempower the targeted community. Its utility as a powerful weapon of war arises from how it works to install a disrupted heteronormativity. The violation and violence inflicted on the female body is a means of establishing power of the rapist over not only the rape survivor, but also the community's men as they suffer emasculation in their ability to protect their women. In the closing decades of the 20th century, the use of sexual violence during conflict came to be recognized as a war crime. Sexual violence during conflict was no longer subsumed as an outrage to personal dignity, but as a crime against humanity and as war crimes in both national and international armed conflict. Without detracting from individual trauma and clearly recognizing that the harm of rape is extensive and devastating for the individual, the pernicious bearing of how war or conflict rape contributes to the destruction of communities came to be understood as genocidal violence. The pioneering work of Kelly Dawn Askin demonstrated that sexual assault fulfills five elements of the definition of genocide. And again, the definitions of genocide are contested. And if I had my slides, I would have shown you the definition of genocide I was working with. But there are five elements to this definition of genocide, and if any of these are fulfilled, even the intent of any of these are fulfilled, that the violence is described as genocide. Killing members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C, deliberately inflicting on the group or conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, and E, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Obviously, this is highly contested, how you define genocide, but systematic mass rape can be, many scholars have determined that systematic mass rape of targeted groups is a form of genocide. In this work, I seek to disaggregate the utility of gendered sexual violence in conflict by examining the responses it evokes both within the targeted community and beyond. I hope to explore the political dimensions of its use. I focus on the conflict between the state of India and the Sikhs, an attempt to examine three forms of responses: memory, political feminist philosophy, and a Gurmukh-inspired social action. The approach of this work is feminist, not because of the women, but because women are the subjects, but rather the perspective adopted. Intrinsic to the feminist approach is the attentiveness to the experience of the marginalized. In this work, the marginalized are those subjected to state terrorism in the form of state-sanctioned sexual violence. This is not to detract from terrorist acts carried out by the insurgents, but due to the extreme asymmetry in the frequency and the magnitude of the use by the state and its agents. A critical feminist lens is employed, and I rely on a large body of scholarly work on conflict and war rape that has emerged following on from the pioneering work of legal feminist scholars such as Catherine McKinnon and Kelly Dawn Askin. Claudia Carr's philosophical analysis of genocide is used to explore how genocidal violence functions within a community. I end with a discussion on Sikh women's subjectivity and examine how the Sikh community is informed by its own discursive traditions in response to gender sexual violence. The data I used in this work was a combination of primary and secondary sources, testimonies from the Oral History Project, the 1984 Living History Project, a wonderful project which many people have already talked about today, together with some interviews I've carried out and narratives which I've extracted from many human rights reports, especially by Insaf, 20 Years of Impunity. In the testimonies I considered, I only considered those of actual survivors, eyewitnesses, or immediate family members. I didn't want to incorporate like hearsay or secondary knowledge. After just transcribing interviews, I try to seek commonalities using an inductive method. But first, I'm going to consider the violence in two different ways. One is the collective violence, and the example which everybody knows about is 1984. People often just refer just to Delhi, but as you all know, it happened throughout northern India, not just in Delhi, but many in Haryana, Uttar Pradesh, Gujarat. There's a long list, I'm sorry to say. But this collective mass violence, you know, is not one isolated event in the history of India. Against the Sikhs, there are other episodes. There's the Patna Sahib massacre of 1964, there's the Kanpur massacre of 1978, and there were other minoritized communities throughout India's history post-1947 have experienced this type of collective violence. Gujarat 2002, 1992. The list, I'm sorry to say, is very long. I think everybody, I'm speaking, I'm going to skim through some parts here. In the violence of 1984, Sikh men were the principal targets, and there's lots of evidence from numerous human rights reports that the violence was systematic, organized, prepared, methodical, and had state sanctioned. Following on from Jaspal's work, there is also like the absence of what happened to the women and the children. We do know from the Oral History Project of where people have witnessed how small children were murdered before their eyes, but these are absent from the human rights report. And so in the personal narratives, there are omissions. Testimonies that I'm going to be referring to in this work, there's lots of description of how women saw their husbands and their sons being murdered before their eyes. But in the personal narratives, there are omissions and frequent use of euphemisms and silences. When women spoke of their own experiences, they only mentioned how the mob hounded them, or while in custody, they were disturbed by the security forces. After having witnessed the murder of her eldest son and her husband, one woman spoke of how she left her home to seek help from the authorities, but then the mob got her again, and she was troubled by the mob again. Women gave explicit descriptions when they spoke of the experience of nameless other women or of women who were beyond rehabilitation. One woman spoke of her cousin who was gang-raped, and 30 years later she continues to be traumatized. She is constantly in a disassociative state and completely disengaged from life. In some accounts, there are gaps in the chronology of the events surrounding the abduction and kidnapping of women. It is stated that the women in question went missing for several days, but no reference is made to what actually happened to those women over that period. The women were found alive and sent to refugee camps or returned to their homes. When an interviewer inquired about what happened to one such missing woman, the interviewee repeatedly declared that her daughter lives with her and that she looked after her daughter-in-law. An initial interpretation of this response is that of evasion. The interviewee is evading the question or refusing to acknowledge the sexual violence to which her daughter-in-law may have been subjected. However, another explanation is that the interviewee is cognizant of the interviewer's awareness of the nature of the violence to which these women were subjected, an unspoken public secret, and the question was actually about whether the woman was rejected after the violation of rape. To this question, the interviewee replies emphatically that her daughter remained a member of her family. Other women spoke about how they are not afraid of death and it is life that they fear. Several women stated that they are the living dead. One woman explicitly stated that since 1984 she has been a living corpse. This narrative was very matter of fact, without expression, without emotion, whereas others are replete with rage and grief and are effect laden. It is the narratives of the male survivors that are more explicit, give more explicit descriptions of gendered violence. Women were mauled, their clothing was removed, they were repeatedly violated. Now I'm going to speak about the counterinsurgency in Punjab. In the counterinsurgency, you can read K.P.S. Gill's book, and he explicitly states the methods that they use. If there's an international lawyer here who would want to bring a case against K.P.S. Gill, you just have to use his own book. A woman spoke of how it was the people of the fields who suffered the most, how the security forces would routinely enter people's homes and do terrible things to families in front of families. The intrusion in the home has always had its serious significance, intrusion into the traditionally private space inhabited by women. Male speakers talked of widespread use of sexual violence by the security forces throughout the rural areas of Punjab and not merely in the hotspots of the insurgency. And there's a particular formula. The village would be encircled by the security forces, the army, border security forces, and then the Punjab police would actually enter the village and they would be hunting somebody down. That person would be absent, so therefore they would target the family. So I'm running out of time, but I had wanted to explore these narratives in terms of using themes of memory holes, memory erasure, and doublespeak. I was looking at how memory is formed, which has already been covered today, so I will not go into that, and how important memory is for resilience and recovery. One important point is the silences. The silences, it's undeniable there's silence surrounding the sexual violence inflicted against women during both the collective violence of 84 and post-84 and the ensuing violence in Punjab after 84. When considering the reasons of the survivors' silence with respect specifically to the sexual violence, the loss of the family and the structural violence which the women experienced was the greater violence that they experienced. The silence may arise from the inability for others to inhabit the space of trauma. We are not equipped with a language. How does one construct a sentence with such unfamiliar words like glutmar and carry empathy and understanding and caring with such words? How do we even have that language in a language we are more grounded in? How do we define rape? Claudia Card writes that rape symbolizes who is dominant by forcibly, dramatically removing the most elementary controls anyone can be presumed to want, controls over one's intimate bodily contacts with others. Faced with choiceless choices, the survivor's silence serves a collective survival strategy that functions as a form of resistance. I should explain more, all these ideas of Izzat and patriarchy and the social construct of gender within Punjab, they all work together to silence a woman if she has been raped. If she wants to get married and lead a normal life, in inverted commas, she will have to, they do not have many choices. Sick women and their families invest in what Mina Das describes as a deep moral energy in the refusal to represent certain violations of the human body. This investment permits women to live out their lives within the prevalent social norms of marriage and family. I also wanted to talk about the resistance of the sick communities to the silence. There are cases which are not reported, where villages rose up after acts of sexual violence against women within the village, and the village, all the members of the villages were brutally beaten, and you know that uprising was dramatically put down. Oh, I'm just. I wanted to round up and just say. There are other more points I wanted to make about the sick response to violence, but we can do that another time maybe. But I wanted to say that what sick women experienced has been very perfectly reproduced in Gujarat 2002. Or in other cases throughout India to minorities, and part of not repeating this, or you know, is that the Sikhs have to be very vocal about it. When I have spoken to survivors, they want that this is acknowledged, and one of the reasons why they feel that they're in a state of dissonance with themselves and the community and the people around them is because it's not even acknowledged that this even happened, you know. And that's one step. You know, another step is that even the civil war is never acknowledged that it happened. So there's many layers to this.